Over these last several weeks, we've been looking at a continuing tradition that we find launched in the Rig Veda, continuing through the Upanishads and arriving into the fertile fields of the Gita. Tonight, we're going to look in a different direction. We're going to look at the Sankhya philosophy, the Jaina philosophy, and the Buddhist philosophy, if we have time to get to all of this. These are all interesting fields because they are all non-Vedic in their origination. Sankhya is a word that means enumeration. We'll see why shortly. It's a psychological and philosophic movement that relates to Kapila as the originator. Kapila seems to have been unknown to the Veda, unknown to the Upanishadic tradition. He is figured, his name, by the way, means red, and he's associated with the sun. He arises in mythology when a king is doing a horse sacrifice and releases this horse to roam the earth for a year. But the horse disappears, and as they follow the horse into the earth, they find this horse sitting next to this sage who is in deep meditation. He is clearly a rishi, but they want their horse back and they start to take him, at which point Kapila opens his eyes and all 60,000 warriors are burnt up by the force of his vision. So clearly a man with a strong sight and not to be trifled with. What Kapila saw was what we would call the self, the real self. The earliest distinctions that we have seen of self from nature were recorded in the Katha Upanishad, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, to some extent in the Chandogya and in the Brihadaranyaka. And all of these Upanishads seem to have some penetration of Sankhyan ideas into them. They may not have known the author, may have been unaware of Kapila, but this is fundamental, because when we take an analytical view at ourselves, when we ponder what we are, and we sit, for instance, in meditation, and we look at our body, and we feel our body, yet we know we're not simply our body. And then we can feel the life force moving through us. We can understand that there's energy profoundly vibrating in us, but we're not just that energy, just as we were not that body. And we keep looking, and we look at our mind, and we see an ocean or a marketplace filled with thought activity. And yet we know this too is not us, because something in us continues to witness, continues to see all of this relentless activity. So whether it's intellectual or emotional, vibrational or bodily sensations that assail us, who are we that is being assailed? Who are we that's being invited to come and dance in the universe? And Kapila's great realization is that that is the self. Pull back from all this play of nature, because that's what all of it is. Even our most intimate threadings in ourself are still just part of a universal play, and that's not us. We are something essential and silent and undisturbed behind, just as the sage was at the center of the earth with the horse standing, sitting next to him, the figure of life who has become calmed in the presence of the great sage and does not himself want to leave that place. So the sage, with his vision, destroys that which would imperil and imprison that life force again. The meaning of the myth is clear. So the Sankhya philosophy, in enumerating, starts with 24 principles of nature and arrives at a 25th, which is the Purusha. Yes, we start with the externalities of the earth, but all these externalities have inner components. The senses are not just gross, they're also subtle. And things build up as we follow back this chain. We find that it leads us all the way to the construction of the mind. The mind is out there busily gathering data, subtle and gross, combining it, and then passes it on to the person who thinks he's in charge, the I-maker, Ahamkara. And that Ahamkara examines this and says, I am looking, I am wondering, I am. But as he looks up and he sees that it isn't this ego sense that he primarily is. There's a level of intelligence above. So in climbing to that, one attains a wise, tranquil view of things. But who is it that is looking? Who is at the peak of that tranquility? Still, it is a creation of nature. Even the buddhi, at its most luminous, is simply reflecting the light from some other consciousness. And what is that? And then the buddhi falls into silence, and only the light of the Purusha remains. Then one is free. The soul has separated itself from nature and can be free. Now, in the Sankhya philosophy, it is immediately recognized that if there's only one nature and one Purusha, then the Purusha seeing itself clear of nature would mean that all Purushas, that everybody would be enlightened with the enlightenment of one. So there cannot be one Purusha. There must be many, many Purushas. Maybe they're limitless, but always nature is one. Even when it seems to be individualized, when it's made and shaped according to our designs, this is a fundamental truth, that soul and nature are different. So how does the world come into being? Because there are two seemingly eternal principles. One is the Purusha, uninvolved really in nature, and the other is Prakriti. Prakriti, Samkhya says, in its origination is still. In its mula, root form, it is still. Nothing is stirring. It is only when Purusha turns its gaze to Prakriti that Prakriti begins to move. And then what comes into play are three modes. The three gunas begin to emerge from this primordial nature. And as they launch into motion, action is created. Karma is created. And then as that karma moves, one thing leads to another. And the Purusha or Purushas watching, who become entranced by this movement, become enmeshed in it. And then they rise or they fall according to the movement of the gunas. And so Sankhya says that that leads to suffering. The only way to escape from it is to disengage, to draw this sharp distinction between soul and nature. This is the style of Sankhya that we see reflected in the Gita, which we just finished studying. It will become systematized still more in centuries subsequent to the Bhagavad Gita. And its mark will be made on every subsequent Indian philosophy. All will have to deal with it if they're in the stream of Indian thought. The idea of the gunas, the play of Prakriti, continues up until the present day. Radhakrishnan, Sri Aurobindo, still were formulating their philosophy in part to deal with this question of nature and soul, Purusha and Prakriti. Because how can we have one world if we have two principles who are absolutes and unconnected? Why would they ever be able to relate? It is a question that Sankhya itself does not answer, but the question is posed and left hanging. Note well that all that we would call ourself in normative terms, our personality, the thoughts we prefer, the people we like to hang around, the country that we live in, how we are now as opposed to how we were when we were young, all of this is simply the play of nature. This is not our soul. So to the Sankhya, getting to the knowledge of the soul is the point of departure from ignorance and suffering. You have to have knowledge which is soul-based, and that leads you away from identification with your natural elements. I think that's about as far as we need to go with the Sankhya school and system. We will meet it at every turn. We will refine and sometimes revise our outlook, but this is how the Sankhya appears in early Indian thought. Now, the Sankhya insights that arise with Kapila and those who followed him come from non-Vedic sources. So let's look at that for a moment, and we may talk about it in greater depth later. So there is a strong, vibrant, and impressive culture in India, which originates the Vedic ritual, which composes the hymns of the Rig, the Yajur, the Saman, and eventually the Atharva Veda. They call themselves the Aryans, the noble ones. And we find their strongest and earliest imprint in the Kuru Panchala region of, let us say, northwest India. As I say, it's an impressive culture. It's basically a pastoralist culture. But as it comes into India deeper and deeper, it begins to change because not all of India is comfortable to a pastoral life. And there are many peoples who already lived there. So the culture, as it advances to the east, advances into the Gangetic plain, makes lots of converts. but they're meeting styles of life that may accept some of the primary teachings and leading motifs of the Vedic culture, but maintain some independence also. For one thing, they're more agriculturalists, but they have different kinds of kings as well. Instead of having a strong military ruler, as the Vedic peoples had, theirs is more the sage king kind. And it is more in this realm of the Gangetic plane that we see all of the Upanishads arising. Farthest to the east is where the Brihadaranyaka, which we regard as the oldest, comes into being. And at the most, on the western edge and a little farther than that of the Gangetic plain, is where we see the Taittiriya Upanishad coming into being, and then all of the other Upanishads in between them and around them. We have not even got to the Vindhya Mountains yet. We're not moving to the south of India. This is all in what we regard the northern part of India. So, great Kshatriyas there are unwilling to submit to this simple notion that Brahmins are superior to them, that they are not the only source of wisdom. They have their own sources of wisdom. It's here in this region that we begin to see the Shramanas, the people who are making strong efforts at self-realization, begin to come into being as sort of ascetic communities that are, in a sense, standing apart from mainstream life. I won't go into the entire sociology of this. I will spare you. But it is here that we see two of the great religions in India come into being without reflection back to the Vedic ritualists, to the Brahmanical religion. The first, the earliest, is what we call the Jain religion. We call it that because the last of a long lineage of teachers, Vardhamana, whom we know as Mahavira, the great hero, is also known as the Jina, the one who conquered, the one who was victorious. He was the last in a lineage of 24 teachers. So that would stretch back some centuries, no? 24 teachers. You're looking at 600 years in length. When did Mahavira live? We have gone through something like a revolution in recent decades in the dating of things in ancient India. And it looks like we've had the dates wrong about the Buddha by about 100 years. And we may have had the dates wrong about Mahavira also. He may have been a contemporary of Buddha's, but a bit older. He might have been an old man when Buddha was a young man. His teaching is interesting because it asserts that the primary reality of our being is a soul inside, which is really separable from nature. Sounds familiar. He calls this soul a jiva. And all that is not soul is called ajiva. So all of nature, in a sense, is a kind of grainy material, earthy material that gets mixed up with the gold of what is the soul's nature to form composites. And as the soul gets identified with these composite elements, it comes to forget that it is essentially gold. And this gold, of course, is available to all things. What is interesting about this worldview is that it too says that you can't say when the world began. As in the Sankhya, there is no creator God. It was not fashioned by some being. Simply, in the Sankhya, Purusha exists, Prakriti exists. Here, in the Jnana philosophy, simply, soul exists and nature exists. The world is of an indeterminate length and will go on forever. What is important to us is to know the way back to soulhood, because the soul, in its nature, has knowledge, has sight, has bliss, has power. And so if we can get back to our essential self, then everything becomes clear to us. But we have to get rid of all of the things which would block us from that self-possession. So we have to, in a sense, divide ourselves from it. We have to get rid of the bondages which chain us to nature. We have to cut it away, and in so doing, arrive eventually at moksha, at liberation, the full freedom of the soul. But we can only do that gradually. So how do we start? The very first principle is ahimsa, non-injury. Non-injury in action, non-injury in thought. But the closer we can come to perfect harmlessness, the better we are. And the more we burn up the weight of karma that we carry. But ahimsa does not mean simply not killing ritually animals for Vedic sacrifices. It means not killing anything. Insects are alive also, and the jiva consciousness in them is precious. And to throw harm on any being, animal, vegetable, is a step backwards and towards unconsciousness, towards bondage to nature. And so ahimsa is the first principle. And there are two schools, it is an apposite to mention now, of the Jnana philosophy. One is the Digambaras, where you are clad in the sky. In other words, you're naked, completely naked. Women are not allowed into that field. Only men may become admitted into that fold of Jainism, because it is extreme. This is the group that refuses to harm anything so far as possible, and even holds as an ideal that fasting unto death is a great way to die. And then there is the white-robed school, where a single long piece of cotton is worn about the body. And the insistence on renunciation for that school is not so strong. And it may be that that is the earlier school, actually. I don't mean, again, to wander into a material that takes us away from the main point, but women were far better regarded in the Jnana school than they were in other philosophies and cultures within India. They were accorded more freedom, and In fact, one of the great illuminates, one of the ones who attained and stood as a plank in the Jaina structure, was a woman who was in fact a queen. There is also the need to speak the truth, satya, to act always in accordance with truth, to live in a way that is without attachment, without grasping for things, asteya, to live in a state of aparigraha. So you can see that when we complete that with the idea of brahmacharya, that there is a complete set of observances that the Jains put together to purify and remedy our attachment to the world, both in the way we deal with ourselves and the way we deal with society, that predates by hundreds of years what would become the teaching in the Yoga Sutras. Some of these ideas in the Jaina philosophy will also appear in Buddhism and have a strong imprint on Buddhism. But for the Jaina, it is primarily an ascetic movement that leads you to that state of final soulhood. Meditation has a role, but it's simply to calm and bring into a state of equilibrium the various aspects and contents of the mind flow. And of course, the Jain religion was important in Indian polity as well. It looks as if one of the great kings in Indian history, Chandragupta Maurya, was in fact a Jain and sponsored the Jain religion. And so you can see throughout the kingdom that he controlled from Magadha, is that how you say Madan? To the east and to the west, many Jain temples were constructed. Their religion flourished for a long time, but when they began to lose royal patronage, and after a famine had struck down many of their greatest ascetics who were carrying in their heads, as you know, the oral literature of the people, much of the early compositions of the Jain mind were lost. So in later centuries, it was reconstructed by the best thinkers of the day. And we have a number of precious documents now. One of the interesting characteristics of a Jain thinker is Aneka Kantavada, which begins with the idea Syat, perhaps. They have the sense that no human who has not attained final emancipation can know anything absolutely. So you can't take anything as true without examining all other possibilities. Even Jainism. So a typical sentence might begin, Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is not. Perhaps it is and is not. Perhaps it is, but is undefinable. Perhaps it is not, but it is undefinable. Perhaps it is and is not, but is undefinable. Perhaps it is and is not, etc., etc. You get the point. And on it goes. So, to weigh and to look and to distinguish requires an analysis and a stance that detaches one from one's egoistic moorings, as with the Sankhya, in our favorite thoughts, and this is my favorite body, etc., etc. So that one can be untied to anything. This idea of a renouncer is important. So now we've seen that the sramanas, the renouncers, the effortful ones who become jhanas, have some kinship with those wild, long-haired Keshins and Munis and Yatis from the Vedic tradition who are moving in and around society, but sort of standing outside society. And society here means Brahmanical society. They have a vibrant life. They have a truth-centered life, too. Theirs is a valorized society, but it's not Brahmanical. It does not accept the authority of the Veda. Around this time also, we find that we've got the arisal of Buddhism in the figure of the Buddha. Before I move to the Buddha, I have to tell you, I forgot to mention that not only was there a queen who was important to the Jain tradition, but Mahavira was himself a prince and came from the Kshatriya community, the warrior community, the ruling class. And so his idea of being a conqueror, we may come back and speak about another time. When we come to the subject of the illumined one, the enlightened one, the Buddha, again, we begin in a royal palace because he was the prince Siddhartha Gautama, born in an area in North India bordering what we call Nepal now, part of the Magadha kingdom, I would presume, because he spoke Magadhi better than he spoke other languages, and that's what he wound up doing most of his discourses in when later he began to teach. The myth of his birth we find echoes of later when Yeshua is born in Bethlehem and lives his life in Jerusalem. Some of these ideas from the Buddha and his mythology were transferred westward and arrive in Christianity in changed form, but still powerfully similar. Buddha's mother gives a kind of celestial birth to her boy. And I think you've probably all read the story of Buddha's life. So rather than rehearse it here, let me note that when you study the early history of Buddhism, everything about his birth up until the point of his struggle to achieve enlightenment is mythological. And then, bam, it suddenly becomes matter of fact. This is what I did. This is how I attained it. And from the point of his enlightenment on, it's straightforward. He's talking to you just as a fellow who managed to break free, and he wants to help you if he can. So I'm going to pick up his story in that same vein. He is born as a kshatriya. He is born as a prince to a king who, of course, affords him all the wealth that his country can give. But this is part of that sage king kind of culture. So he would early on have learnt the wisdom teachings prominent in that kingdom. He would not have been kept away from religion. He would not have been kept away from the things of the world which would have been abhorrent to him. His father would not have been afraid that his son, if he looked for spiritual truth, would run away. I think you can see in the Buddha an increasing interest, likely growing, in what is the real solution to life. What is fundamentally valuable? Because we find him marrying, having his own son, enjoying all the pleasures of the court, literature, music, everything, but nothing satisfies him. He is relentlessly looking for something more. And so it leads him to renounce and go off to find out what the answer is. Perhaps there's a strong vairagya in him, feeling repelled, revulsion, I guess is the word, at the glamour or the languor that comes from having too much wealth. And he goes out and he does just the opposite. He becomes a renunciate. He practices the most extreme kinds of asceticism. But they don't lead him to enlightenment. He learns how to throw himself into abstract states of consciousness that no one else virtually can reach. He studies with the best teachers. And again, they seem to be non-Vedic teachers. He seems to gain some impression of what some of the teachings are in some of the Upanishads, and he knows their arguments and he knows their insights, but he doesn't find the answer anywhere. So, almost having fasted himself to death, he decides to break his fast, and he eats a little food kindly given to him by a beautiful young woman. And he sits and he thinks, when was I happiest? And he remembers being in his father's glades. And he's sitting in the cool shade of an apple tree. And he said, is this the path to enlightenment? And he said, and the answer arose in me, yes, this is the path to enlightenment. He actually had a conversation with someone about this, who was a Jaina, a follower of the Jain religion. Buddha had just finished speaking about another set of renouncers the Ajivikas. And this man said, what is the nature of your enlightenment and how did you get there? What was that moment like? What started you? This was it. He stopped and he realized, when was I happiest? Because nothing around him was pulling on him. He simply was in a state of harmony with the nature about. Not searching, not reaching, not thirsting, simply there. And then he went through a practice of four states of meditation to completely clear his mind, completely be empty, so that he would be carrying nothing with him, and then he sat with a resolve to finally have the breakthrough, and he got that enlightenment, supreme enlightenment. And he could see to the past, he could see to the future. He could also see that he could remain where he was and simply live in that state which he called nirvana, where all falsities are blown out, where everything that you're reaching for is gone. There is no I to reach anymore. He could stay there, but as he looked back at the world, in a sense, he heard the world's cry for his help. And he said, if I go, what I teach will not be heard well. It will be misconstrued. It won't last. It will become impaired with time. It will pass out of existence. And he sighed. He said, but if I don't go back, no good will be done. And I alone will have this. So he went back into the world. And he met immediately his old group of friends who had been practicing severe austerities with him. And they said, because he had had some food, you look pretty well. And he said, well, I have finally discovered, and I'll tell you about it. And he said the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There's a cause of suffering. There's a way to get out of suffering. And then there's the Eightfold Path that takes you there. And I don't know that we're going to have time to go much farther into the Buddha's teaching tonight. But we can say this much more about the manner in which he spoke. The Buddha was a king by birth, and he was filled with metta, filled with loving kindness for others. Understand this about Buddha. He was a great genius. Perhaps the greatest spiritual personality ever to have walked on India's soil. When he went out to speak, he spoke in discourses to people, and he took his followers with him. And if you can imagine this great kshatriya, who is now a sage, carrying an army of mendicants with him, this was impressive. Now, in old days, sages, rishis, used to argue with each other, have debates to see who would win. It sort of came with the territory. Oh, do you know so much? Then answer this question. And one would answer, and then another would say, aha, I can offer a better answer than that. Then he would speak. But when it came to the Buddha, he said, yes, I will debate in order to help you. I have nothing to win from you. But really, look at these things that you have. You have a body, you have a mind, you are beset with troubles. I can show you a way out of them. Because you are built from a number of aggregates. And somehow, over the course of time, you've come to think that this aggregation is really you. But if you were like a wagon and you had a platform and you had an axle and you had wheels and you had a handle and somebody was pulling you along, you'd be a wagon as long as you were pulling along. But if your wheel came off, if they took off your handle, if they moved the platform elsewhere, if the axle were dismantled, where would that wagon be? Where has it gone? And this is the self you believe in. Because you believe in that self, you suffer. I can show you how to find what is true behind. Well, was the universe created? Is there a God? I can't answer that question. The question doesn't arise. The question doesn't arise because the same aggregate is asking. And what you want is an eternalist answer, where I tell you that you'll live forever, or a nihilist answer, where I say, no, you're doomed. And then you'll either go along in a fiction or you'll give up. But neither of those is the right choice. The right choice is this eightfold path that I'll show you, and which will lead you eventually to full enlightenment. Well, it looks like the Buddha prevailed in every contest. Of course, a lot of these sages who would be his opponents probably were not used to the kind of argumentation that he subjected them to, because he would ask simple questions based on your real everyday experience and lead you from point A to point Z, where you were forced to conclude that, yes, what I have believed all this time is a lie. And I've told myself that lie. And now I have to stand up and act for myself. Buddha was a master psychologist. He was India's first great psychologist after Kapila. We have to give that insight to Kapila first to be able to distinguish between this and that. So Buddha was telling us that all that we believe ourselves to be is this aggregation of natural elements, which have come into some kind of configuration in a universe that is perpetual. We don't know how it came into being. We don't know when it will ever end. But as long as there is action, there will be reaction. There will be a chain of causation. And we think that we're tied to that. So if that is not us, then what is? Do you suddenly see the parallel between the Sankhya teaching and the Buddhist teaching? If you take out the Purusha from the Sankhya, essentially you have the Buddhist teaching. What does Buddha want to erase? Dukkha, suffering. What is it that the Sankhyans want to erase? Dukkha, suffering. When Buddha was asked, what is the nature of the self? He said, there is no self. No self that you believe in. What you think is yourself is not a self. Look and say, if I cut you open right now and reached inside, would I find that soul that you talk about? Is that where that soul is? It is not there. Why do you believe in it? So when you ask me the question, Buddha would say, it is not edifying to answer. That is not the question. You have to get your mind clear of this false construct of the ego, which desires, which thirsts, tanha, for things. And then we can get you back eventually to a realization of nirvana. Now, is nirvana simply the abolition of all being? Is it a destruction of all awareness? Buddha seems to say, in his middle way, no, it is a state of supreme delight. It is a state of conscious existence. Because if he experienced it, right, when he had the enlightenment, and yet he continues to act in the world, then there is still some sense of consciousness that can direct itself volitionally. Something is or is not. The is not is the fictional ego. The is an undefinable, but the ego has been blown out. That is the nirvana. No longer believing in this fictional self is what gives us the ultimate freedom. Now, his teaching to advanced practitioners was not written down in his day. And it looks like it was very practical. He was so great a psychologist that he could look into someone and see what was the nature of how they were stuck and be able to give them a method that would work for them, personalized method. What is wonderful about it is that we know something like 200 people, at least 200 people in his lifetime attained nirvana, attained enlightenment. That is fantastic. When you think of how difficult it is for a tradition, spiritual tradition, a parampara, to take the quintessence of its teaching and have it come alive in a disciple here and there, one is lucky. But Buddha, till the age of 80 he lived, was able to induce that change of consciousness in 200 people. We have to honor him. Even if we don't agree with his worldview, we have to see how great he was. I'm going to speak more about Buddhism next week, so the balance we'll save till then. If you have any questions, we can answer them now.